Well, welcome everybody to this roundtable discussion. The topic, of course, is alternative medicine. And the first thing that I think we need to do is say what it is. We're going to go by the working definition that it is whatever is not taught in conventional medical schools. I think that's the easiest definition to go by. And the very first thing we'll do is we'll go around the table and introduce everybody so that you know what this is all about, who we are, and why we're here. We do have sort of a cross-selection of people representing sort of all areas of scientific life. But I think what ties all of us together is that I think we all have a love of science, and we all like evidence-based science. That's the common feature. So let me start by, first of all, introducing and welcoming our guests. To my left here, Dr. Paul Offit, who I'm sure all of you know because he is one of the world's experts on vaccines. He is actually a professor of vaccinology and the developer of the rotavirus vaccine, which has saved countless lives. He has been a vocal critic of the autism vaccination link and has certainly challenged Andrew Wakefield at all levels. I'm sure we'll hear about that. Dr. Harriet Paul is a former Air Force flight surgeon, although has not done any surgery in flight, but now is known as the Skep Doc and writes extensively on her website, as well as for Skeptical Inquirer and for Skeptic Magazine on all kinds of medical topics which have questionable evidence. Dr. Edzard Ernst comes to us from London, although he was educated first in Germany. And he holds the distinction of being the first ever in the world professor of complementary medicine at Exeter University. He has certainly made huge contributions to the scientific community, having published hundreds of papers and written a book called Trick or Treatment, which is an excellent compilation of many of the nonsensical remedies that are out there. And he has had a history of confrontation with the likes of Prince Charles. Mm-hmm. And as he told me, he expects not to be invited to Prince Charles's coronation. So is that correct? You won't be there.
I hope it's such a long time ahead that I'm maybe not alive anymore.
And Dr. Bob Park is a professor of physics from the University of Maryland and writes a weekly newsletter which circulates to thousands and thousands of people. And he certainly is in the skeptical vein. He has looked into extensively the cell phone controversy, electromagnetic radiation, and has written a wonderful book called Voodoo Science, where he explores Voodoo science. Going around the table, Stephen Strauss is one of Canada's most noted journalists. He, for many, many years, was a science journalist, science writer for the Globe and Mail, now writes for the CBC website, has written books, and writes for numerous other publications, and of course has a great interest in alternative medicine. Bill Brownstein is a reporter for the Montreal Gazette, who writes on virtually any topic, especially ones that are suggested to him by me. and he wrote a great article on our conference. Dr. Ari Benchetrit is a Montreal plastic surgeon, and he is a strong proponent of science-based medicine, most of you are, and I don't think you do homeopathic brain enlargements.
Hasn't sold well.
Dr. Mark Roper is a Montreal family doctor and also links to the Quebec government. and is at least to some degree in charge of how new doctors get positions in the Wanchal area through this process that we call PREM, which is a physician to practice. And I know that Dr. Roper was very upset the other day when he heard on the radio a naturopath suggesting to someone who had breast cancer, I think it was, that they should be jumping on a trampoline for lymphatic drainage. Dr. Brian Ward is a McGill professor, well known for his research in vaccination. Obviously, he shares a great deal with Dr. Offit, and the others. I guess an immunologist is what you would call yourself, no?
Only when I'm not around immunologists.
Dr. David Rosenblatt is a professor of medical genetics. In fact, he's the director of McGill's
Department of Human Genetics.
Department of Human Genetics. Obviously, also with a shared interest in getting to the core with evidence. Dr. John Hopper is also a physician in the Jewish General Hospital. And he does some very, very interesting research at internists, but has looked into the possibility of using vitamin C intravenously for the treatment of cancer. So interested to hear about that. My two colleagues here, Ariel Fenster and David Park, work with me in the Office for Science and Society. And of course, we discuss science-based evidence or evidence-based science on a daily basis, and that really is our passion, and talking about passion. Lauren Trachy, of course, who initiated this whole concept, has the biggest passion for science I've ever seen, and that's the reason that we are, in fact, all here. I did make some copies so that you have, you know, some idea of just what our guests write about. Certainly, just one kind of snapshot, but it at least gives you an idea. So perhaps we can start by asking our guests to briefly speak on what their idea of alternative medicine is, and any sort of personal views on it, and any confrontations that you may have had, any kind of interesting anecdote of you know, why I think you are a champion of evidence-based medicine. Maybe we'll start.
Okay, I guess one thing you said that I wish was true, but I'm not sure it is the notion that the alternative has to be defined as something that's not taught in medical schools. What I find, anyway, at least at the University of Pennsylvania, is that there is someone who teaches alternative medicine there and is pretty much non-critical about the evidence that doesn't support it. Further, if you go, for example, in our division of oncology, the unit, at least the adult hospital, they offer aromatherapy, they offer Reiki, you know, that you can be, you know, you can come in contact with a Reiki master who can help, you know, manipulate your energy. So I think, you know, there are certainly many academic centers that have, you know, divisions of holistic or integrative or complementary medicine. So I think it has moved much more into academia than one would have liked, because I think it's an industry in which there's a lot of money at. So I'm afraid the division isn't quite as
big. Yeah, I think David Gorski, who writes for the science-based medicine website, calls that quackademia. Harriet?
Well, we don't think there is any such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine that works and medicine that doesn't, or that hasn't been tested. And if something is tested and is proven to work, it becomes medicine. It's no longer called alternative. Stephen Novella from our science-based medicine website has a wonderful quotation. I can't remember the exact wording, but it's to the effect that alternative medicine is not a scientific term. It's a made-up propaganda term that's designed to promote quack remedies and unproven remedies and things that are not accepted by science. It's just a propaganda term. And some people like to call it so-called alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. It has a nice acronym, SCAM.
Well, I think you have some strong views on the difference between alternative and complementary.
Well, I have views on terminology in general. I think what we could almost define this field as the field that tries to rebrand itself every 5 years or so. It used to be called alternative medicine, and that's how we discuss it today. That's how Medline lists it, and that's how the man in the street probably knows about it. And it assumes that people use it as an alternative, which rarely is the case. And when people realize that this isn't really a good term, for that reason they called it complementary medicine. My chair, which started 18 years ago in Exeter, was called chair of complementary medicine, is still called chair of complementary medicine. And that isn't quite right either, because some people do use it as an alternative. And therefore, the term complementary and alternative, short CAM, was established, and that was used for a long time. And now people come with yet another term, and they call it integrated medicine, which is probably the most infuriating term of all of them, because it's just a smokescreen behind which people smuggle unproven treatments or disproven treatments into routine care. All these terms are confusing to not just to us, more importantly to the man in the street who actually in this field does make therapeutic decisions, because therapeutic decisions are different than in plastic surgery or gynecology, neurology, or whatever. It's the man or the woman, more likely the woman in the street, who decides to use this or that treatment, often without input from healthcare professionals. And these terms are very confusing. Over the last 18 years, I've become totally disenchanted with all of them, and I think if we talk acupuncture, we should call it acupuncture. If we talk homeopathy, we should call it homeopathy. And these umbrella terms are very confusing and just as much.
Dr. Park, as a physicist, why interest in alternative medicine?
Well, I got into it more or less by accident. While serving as the Washington voice of the physics community in the United States. But the first thing that struck me when I believe the first problem that I encountered was a claim of building a perpetual motion machine. And that's a physicist's problem. But when I got into that, I began to find that, you know, this was going on in all fields. But I've been drawn primarily by those cases where a physicist has something to say. Physicians aren't the only ones that can comment on this kind of medicine. Everything from homeopathy to these other things that go on, a physicist is in a perfect position to do it. And we don't do it very often. And I'm puzzled by that.
Well, you do it very well in Voodoo Science in the book. Stephen, your interest, and to what degree in alternative medicine?
Well, I guess what I find interesting is the fact that we were talking earlier. I'm not sure that the evidence-based people affect the people who believe in alternative medicine. I'm not sure. I'm looking at a community of people who said, show me the evidence and then I'll decide what to do. It would be my observation that you end up with two streams, and they actually in some kind of way fundamentally don't talk to one another from the perspective of true effectiveness. So if you want the disproof of evidence-based medicine, read the obituary pages. You know, so-and-so, after a long battle with something, died, and you say, well, you know, look, that's evidence that traditional medicine doesn't work. And when faced with those things, it seems to me that what people do is, and I've actually watched people I know do this, they say, well, okay, I'll try something else because this isn't working. When you end up with that kind of, how shall we say, it's not a contradiction, it's a paradox. I don't know how one has a conversation. So,
talking about those obituaries, as you say, you very often see someone pass away from such a disease, and thanks to the doctors of such and such a hospital for all their care, you rarely see a reference to a homeopathic hospital, and thanks to all the homeopaths for having kept them alive that long.
Do you think actually it speaks well of medicine when they say, and thanks for the care, and they're dead? I don't know.
Bill, you write about all kinds of things.
I get a lot of desperate people who write. The case with autism and vaccination is very germane here because in Quebec, it's one of the few places where you're not actually forced to vaccinate. And as a consequence, when that whole stuff was coming out about the possible link, which has since been debunked, you get an awful lot of very desperate people who will cling on anything for some kind of solution to a problem. And as Stephen points out, people just want to believe, in spite of all the evidence that you can throw at them that there's epidemics of measles as a consequence, they're grasping at anything. And I mean, it's sad because they don't care about evidence. They care mostly about any pie in the sky kind of antidote panacea to all their woes. And you see that in almost every level. Like, I mean, I have people like who phone me or write me that reflexologists or aromatherapists, and you know, they've got the ultimate cure and all the rest, but they feed upon people who are very, very vulnerable. And I think that's the saddest thing of all, because I guess when you're in that kind of desperate situation, you're looking for anything. And I wish they did pay attention, but sadly that's not the case.
There's an outbreak of measles in Quebec now.
Yes. I think all of North America.
Yeah, but especially here because of that, because it's the only province, I believe, where it isn't legal. I mean, it isn't illegal not to have your kid vaccinated.
Harry, being a plastic surgeon in your area, I mean, the evidence is pretty clear whether something has worked or not, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly in the surgical field, it's quite clear. But in the non-surgical field, which is by far the fastest growing part of plastic surgery or cosmetic medicine, we're talking about ancillary treatments such as injections, lasers, et cetera. For every product that does work and has a scientific basis to it and has peer-reviewed journals, there's a whole set of products that, you know, try to resemble that product and of course, don't. And you might remember the headlines of a certain product where the headline of their ad was, is this better than Botox? And that was the headline. And, of course, if you read the article, it had absolutely nothing to do with Botox. It was right on the coattails of a pharmaceutical product that has been tested and has existed for 30 years and proven itself. And then you've got this pseudo product that they've come out with, which has zero testing, has zero evidence that it works, and they're, you know, trying to ride on the coattails of a known product. And you see a lot of that, whether it be with, again, injections, whether it be with, I was talking with Dr. Ernst about products like Arnica, which are natural supplements, which in theory decrease bruising and swelling after surgery, but again, there's absolutely no scientific evidence that it does. And I do spend a lot of my time trying to debunk these myths to my patients, but as Dr. Ernst came up with the line, there is physician fatigue. At some point, you almost get to that point where you're sermonizing on an individual patient basis and realizing you're not going to get anywhere that way. Either you mass educate or you kind of give in if it's not harmful.
Mark, being a family physician, I mean, you must get patients trooping into your office with printouts from the internet, having diagnosed themselves and having cured themselves.
I suppose I'm impacted on this at many levels. I mean, in my office, as head of the division of primary care at the MAC, I end up on the radio and television a fair amount as well, being interviewed, and I meet the alternative medicine model there. Sometimes I'm on your radio station, not necessarily your station, and right after I've been talking, there'll be an ad for a colonic cleanse right after I finish. But, you know, there are a number of...
Don't take it personally.
Some things are out of our control. But it's a fascinating topic. There's so many subjects. One of the things I think is important is having a scientific journalist who translate our talk to the public. And I know in Duke University there's a well-developed sub-specialization of journalism at that school. And I remember being interviewed once by a CBC journalist, and I stopped her and I said, "Is this your first medical interview?" She said, "Actually, yes, I was doing another topic on schools last week." And I said, "Well, I'm going to give you actually a 2-hour lecture on this topic before we can even, we don't have time to do that." And I asked the CBC, I said, "Send me your medical journalist the next time." She says, "Oh, he's based in Halifax. We only have one, and he's based in Halifax." So that's one aspect I'd like to bring up. But it's a fascinating field for a lot of topics.
Brian, well, you see some of the vaccination spin-off.
Yeah, so on the one hand, I had the pleasure of working with the Department of Justice lawyers through much of the summer of 2007, trying to defend against the more autism in the mega trial, and that was an eye opener. First of all, the U.S. Department of Justice lawyers who are doing that are underpaid, massively underpaid, because we were working from 7 in the morning until 11 at night, and then doing it again the next day through most of the month of June in 2007, and it took actually 2 years to get the final result, which was probably the most satisfying decision from the vaccine court, where a fairly conservative special master basically said you have to be like the Queen of Hearts in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland to believe 7 improbable, if not impossible, events before breakfast to believe the outcome that proponents were trying to put forward. On the other hand, however, I spent a couple of years working in a Thai refugee camp where we saw thousands of people a day in the hospitals there. And we were really very happy to have the complementary alternative traditional healers in a facility right beside us. And I have to say that I was quite bothered by prickly heat, the thing that a lot of Caucasians get when they go to the tropics for the first time. And none of the Western approaches worked. And finally somebody said, go to the Thai healers. And they basically put me in a sauna, whacked me with a specific set of twigs, basically exfoliated my entire body, dyed me yellow so I was sweating orange and yellow for the next 3 days. But it went away. And so there's always the other hand, as Dr. Hall was saying. As soon as you can prove that it works, then it becomes standard medicine. And I think that we don't actually spend enough effort to try to figure out which ones of these things do work. Because clearly some of them do work. Think of artesanates. Think of chinchona bark. They started as traditional alternative medicines.
So are you flagellating with those twigs?
I wish I knew what it was. But I do tell people who go, if they're tortured by prickly heat, to go to the local people, because they know how to fix it.
David, I mean, your area is about as scientific
as reductionist as you can get. But I was very struck by what Stephen said, because you have to look at things as a person, as a citizen, rather than as a physician or as a scientist. And so you want to say, I've come to a point in my life where I say everything is now sociology. And so you cannot look at anything outside of context. So medical schools now, I've been around at McGill, I have a 35-year pin, which I call my Mubarak pin. And you have one later than that. But we get a lot of talk about whole patient care and actually taking the science out of the curriculum. The science is there, but looking at the patient as an individual and what they're trying to get out of it. And often, I think the problem is that we said, many of the patients, everybody ends up dead, right? We all do, right? And medicine is promising more than it can deliver. And science, in many ways, promises a lot. And when you look for actual applications, so when you found what the cause of sickle cell anemia was, for example, you know, when the change was that by maybe 1956, that didn't lead immediately, you know, to treatment and eradication of sickle cell anemia. So you go on TV, and all the drug companies are saying, ask your doctor about this, and obviously they have a different agenda. So none of us are purists, and all of us are answering to a different master, and the poor person in the street has what their grandparents have told them and what their community is telling them, and statistically, you know, the doctors will say, you know, this percentage of patients will get the response to anything, but they don't care. They say, what's it going to mean to me? And, you know, I always like to, you know, some people, you know, you go up to St. Joseph's Orphery and you tell stories about it, you know, the holy water, and you see lots of crutches there. So I look at it sort of like Stephen Jay Gould. You have different worlds.
The crutches are okay. It's the artificial legs that are a mystery.
Did they
grow a new leg?
But society is very complicated. People are very complicated. We try to bring things down to the simplest level. Evidence-based is based on large numbers. I'm working in an area of very rare disorders. Okay, there may be three or four people in the world with the same disorder. How do you do evidence-based medicine on something that's like that? You know, I had one case, a child was treated after birth. The other child was treated a little bit earlier. The one did earlier did better. You write a paper, a wonderful response to early treatment. But you know, if you had a million people with the same disorder, there'd be huge variability. And how do you take the science to that? And the person in the street, all they want to do is have some solace from the doctor they're going to, some support from the people around them, and some feeling that the interventions that are there are not being driven by drug companies or by professional stature or some other reward system. So I find this is the whole question very complicated.
John, you have a different perspective, I'm sure, on some of these things, both as an internist and as background in nutrition.
I will start by saying I'm completely and totally committed to the process that we now call evidence-based medicine, and which implies and is based on scientific, rational thinking and analysis, and the rules of evidence and the rules of science. I'm also aware that there's massive ignorance about scientific thinking amongst the general population, even amongst otherwise highly sophisticated people, my wife, for example. And just in preparing to come here, I read one of my favorite books called Science and Anti-Science, written by actually a physics historian at MIT, and he pointed out that almost half of Americans don't know how long it takes the Earth to go around the sun. So there's all kinds of problems in terms of that. I'm not a proponent of alternative medicine, but I'm fascinated by what it is and perhaps what benefits it might have at a societal level. What I mean is that one way that I think evidence that alternative medicine could help is by challenging conventional Western medicine. Because what I practice is conventional scientific Western medicine, and I'm appalled at the lack of application of that method in routine clinical care. I'm thinking, therefore, that simply saying that using a therapy that works defines acceptable medicine, a therapy that doesn't work as alternative medicine wouldn't work, because I would guess that a great degree of what we do in conventional medicine isn't based on adequate scientific evidence. And if one were to claim, therefore, that certain therapies that are widely used in clinical medicine are alternative medicine, that wouldn't work, because that would cognitively not work. I think what alternative medicine really is has to be thought about, and I agree 100% with Dr. Ernst, it's probably not helpful to put an umbrella over a whole variety of different practices. First of all, there's fraudulent practices, there's quacks, there's con men, and those have existed throughout history, and they will always continue. But that isn't, to me, defining the whole cultural, sociological phenomenon that complementary alternative medicine is used to define. For example, I was involved in helping set up Canada's Natural Health Products Directorate. And you remember that was a political action, that's more than 15 years ago now, in which they were trying to find a fast track for health for non-dangerous products that weren't food, but that were food-like products. And one of the concepts that emerged that I learned from that was that there are many practices which we call complementary alternative medicine, traditional Chinese medicine is one of them, which are actually embedded in certain cultural practices which go back a long time and which are very meaningful for people and which provide help and solace and great satisfaction to people who take those treatments. Now, trying to fit those practices which have elements that go beyond the pharmaceutical way of evaluating the therapy and trying to assess them using that perspective, I don't think is going to lead to a helpful conclusion or a helpful way of introducing change or benefiting society. The fact, sad as it may seem or be, is that alternative medicine and a variety of practices are extremely popular. I think perhaps at least a half of U.S. medical schools and maybe a similar number of Canadian medical schools have programs, as puzzling, baffling, inconsistent as they are in complementary medicine or integrative medicine. And they're popular. The students, in some cases, the students ask for them. There's many clinical practice, primary care practices that seem to function very well when they introduce integrative so-called practices, that is the physicians will practice their conventional degree of medical practice, but they'll have someone who does acupuncture or does something else on the side. Patients, the population seem very pleased with the surveys I checked. High degrees of satisfaction in the general public, rivaling satisfaction with general medicine by the public who go to them. Now, what is it they want? They're getting something, they want something, and they're finding something that gives them satisfaction. My guess is that government loves alternative medicine for obvious reasons, and the practices and the laws enacted by Canadian and other governments, U.S. government, particularly with their health supplements bill, it's quite old now. Why were those enacted? Why did the National Institutes of Health have a complementary alternative medicine center, not an institute, set up? Why? Because the people really, really, citizens really like those kinds of things. They really want them. And I would suspect that the government, that the Ministry of Health in Quebec is very pleased that there's a lot of complementary and alternative medicine in Quebec, because there's the worried well, there's the people with minor complaints, the disturbances, the anxieties, the problems, the difficulties, various non-specific, complicated, difficult to interpret, time-consuming complaints that if they go to see their primary care physician, they will leave with a prescription for an antidepressant drug for which evidence-based medicine suggests minimal benefit. Whereas if they go and but significant side effects, toxicity and dependence,
they constantly go.
And that's my main point. Whereas those patients, if they go to see a naturopath or massage therapist or do Tai Chi or Qigong or some other practice or take vitamin supplements, over the counter of course, not covered by our health services, they will be dealt with, and indeed they will probably have an equal level of satisfaction.
I think
they've seen a medical care.
The danger comes in when they start using alternative treatments for serious diseases where conventional care could help. Like, for example, I mean, you must have some experience because you're doing the vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C studies, I mean, for cancer. Don't you have patients asking whether or not they should be doing that instead of conventional care?
Almost none. But not. But I'm not disputing that there could be downsides to the fact that the complementary and alternative various versions from traditional to nutritional, and the ones, of course, because my training is in clinical nutrition, are more in that way, or touching, you know, I mean, it's a little hard with holding your hands a few inches above the surface of someone's body for a prolonged period of time. And yet some people occasionally get it. I think what David said is something like, what is the aim of a physician-patient encounter, and what do we get out of it? Because if me as an internist, I see lots of patients who I'm not going to help very much with chronic diseases, and that's one of the other parts that one has to think about, because dislike you may, the unscientific nature of it, the irrationality of it, which to my regret pervades a lot of conventional medicine too, dislike it that though you may, it's not going to go away. And you know, I'm approached by people with extremely high levels of sophistication, even other physicians who want to know about certain practices related to nutrition, and the naivety and lack of rational thinking is apparent. Now, are there harms to, could people avoid seeking proper medical care for sick? Well, of course they could.
Ariel.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to address. I think one of the problems is that what if they use this approach instead of the one that works? You see, the problem, like in Quebec, French speaking, alternative medicine is called la médecine douce. And that is this notion that alternative medicine at least will do no harm. And that's where I think there is a great deal of danger. And maybe in your case you haven't found it, but there are many cases where people will not use treatment that may work because they've been told, well, there is this particular treatment. My cousin has used it and has had great benefit. I was wondering what the panel thinks of it. It's this problem of using alternative medicine instead of conventional medicine, because at least the message is that alternative medicine will do no harm.
Well, Laurent first.
I wanted to take a slightly different look. I mean, we've heard almost, well, it seems like a wide breadth of concerns about this. We three talk about this a lot in the Department of Chemistry, and we try as best we can in four courses that we have in environment, technology, food, and drugs. Students then say, I took drugs at McGill in the fall 2011, it's in the fall term every year. And we bring these topics to their attention. There's about 1,800 students take these courses, and I think we probably haven't tapped their potential to spread good word around, because there's a tremendous intellectual capital sitting there, and I think we could use it in an even better way than we have, just by giving them classes and giving them exams and they get the information, by perhaps deploying them in the city in certain ways to try to gather information and to maybe talk in this kind of fashion in a more effective way than we have before. But we've had 27,000 students go through these courses over the last 30 years, and we hope that we can do it for another 10 or 12 years or maybe more.
20.
But we spend a lot of time talking about how to put this forward to the students
at the level that they are. And of course, we do get a little bit of pushback about homeopathy and topics because they've heard about these from their own home base.
Mark.
Great. Well, I come from a point of view where I think that, you know, real evidence-based science is the gold standard and should be the only standard by which any factual claims, and here we're just talking about medicine, should be evaluated. If one were to accept that these so-called complementary alternative medicine things, for which in most cases actually there's considerable evidence that it does not work, I think to pander to popular sentiment and encourage people to do that, I think is wrong. Science is not a democracy. Science is not a popularity contest. Science comes down to what works, what's proven by experiment. And to pander to the public to say that anything less than that is acceptable, I think does a disservice to society, causes a major misallocation of resources. When people are complaining that medical care costs are skyrocketing, we should be spending our medical dollars on things that work, not on quackery. And also, you know, the people, the widespread anti-scientific beliefs continue in our society. Who knows, it could cause some major problems at some point down the road. Imagine if there was a real pandemic that broke out. Let's say H1N1 was a very serious threat. The amount of, you know, the pseudoscience and conspiracy theories that are out there, just imagine the kind of civil unrest and so on that one would have, the disruption of society that could result from that. So I think that it's the duty of anybody that has a scientific-based education to promote what real science is and make a big distinction between real science and pseudoscience.
Paul, maybe we can ask you to comment because you've been in the trenches in the vaccine, the anti-vaccine movement confrontation. And I know that sometimes you've had threats, serious threats. How do you now look back on the whole Andrew Wakefield situation and the impact that it has had? And the impact that you've had in trying to fight it.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the way that the news media carried that story when it first broke in the late 1990s, up really for the first few years, it was pretty grim. I mean, they told the story as if there were two sides, even though there was only one side was supported by the science. That is not true now. If you watch the way the media covers the vaccine autism story now, it is told from the standpoint of perspective. They don't tell two sides of the story. Now, I think we won, but I think we won for the wrong reasons. And this is going to surprise you, but Andrew Wakefield was wrong. He had a hypothesis that the combination of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. That was that he published a paper that was viewed, unfortunately, by the media as a study when it wasn't. It was just a case series. When studies were done, the best you can say is he raised the hypothesis. When that hypothesis was tested over and over and over again, it was found to be wrong. Wakefield was also not just wrong, he was fraudulent and wrong. And that made a difference, unfortunately, for the media. I think even more so than if he were only wrong. And so his scar fell and fell hard. I mean, he was found to have misrepresented clinical data, misrepresented biological data, laboratory data. And so the media then saw him as a crook and not just a scientist who had raised a hypothesis that was uncorroborated. Which was too bad, because I would have loved to have seen what would have happened if he was simply wrong, because the next person who comes around and has an outlandish hypothesis that also does harm may not be fraudulent. And you'd like to believe that the media would also, you know, come down on the side of science. But, I mean, I think it's been an interesting ride. I mean, for me, the media has been, what I've learned from my experience with the media is that their job is not to educate the public, their job is to entertain the public, to raise the controversy and do little to resolve it, because vaccines are easy. I mean, you know, when you're talking about alternative medicine, you know, there's much that isn't tested here. Because, as Dr. Huffer said, the 1994 Dietary Supplement Health Education Act basically made the FDA stand back. I would argue that actually wasn't a populist movement. I think it was the power of the nutraceutical industry, primarily under the auspices of Jerry Kessler, who really pushed that. He put a lot of money behind that, and he got the public to believe it was in their interest not to know what was in the products they were buying. I mean, how that is called an education act is beyond me, because it's the opposite of education. It's powerlessness. Why the public believes it's better not to know what's in that product is beyond me. But vaccines are easy, because as Brian knows, I mean, vaccines are enormously well-tested pre-licensure, enormously well-tested post-licensure, so we, probably more than any other medical product, have a mountain of evidence on which to stand. So vaccines are easy. That's why I picked it, because vaccines are the easiest of all this. So.
But Kessler was head of the FDA at the time, was he?
Say it again?
Was this the Kessler who was head of the FDA?
No, David Kessler.
A different
Kessler. No, Jerry Kessler was the head of a big nutraceutical company, the name of which I can't remember, but he sort of brought together a group. This is in Dan Hurley's book on natural causes. He sort of goes through that story. No, two Kesslers unrelated.
Hey, I know you have some views on the Dietary Supplement and Health Education Act.
Yes, I think it should be repealed. I would like to say I think we have a lot to learn from the alternative medicine practitioners and the fact that they're pleasing patients. But they shouldn't have a monopoly. That should be part of conventional medicine. If we can incorporate some of the TLC and the long appointment times and the caring attitudes that these people use, we can do a better job with science-based medicine. And what really alarms me is that some of these alternative practitioners are directly criticizing scientific medicine. Chiropractors are saying, don't get surgery, you'll never be the same again, don't take medicines. 50% of chiropractors, by their own studies, discourage vaccinations, so they're endangering our public health. And naturopaths, I did an article on them, I started with their list of things that they characterized themselves by. And they were all things that I learned in medical school. The physician should be an educator, you should treat the whole patient, you should concentrate on prevention rather than trying to play catch-up after someone catches a disease. They're all good things about good scientific medical care that they've tried to co-opt and say that they're doing something special. And then they believe everything that comes down the pipe. They use homeopathy and every kind of quackery along with the natural scientific methods. So my conclusion was that everything they did that was good was not special, and everything that they did was special was not good.
Let's get a European perspective, because Arturans has been a lightning rod in Europe for all the anti-conventional medicine people, including the classic confrontations with Prince Charles. So maybe you can fill us in on you know, just what sort of confrontations arise in Europe, and whether or not, I mean, you know the North American scene as well, whether or not there are major differences.
I think the issues are very much the same, and listening to all of you around the table, the issues are exactly like the ones we have in Europe. The confrontations, usually the confrontations that I had to go through, and it was about one every half year or so, not just the one with Prince Charles, and with Prince Charles I had repeated confrontations. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in my lecture perhaps. But the problems almost invariably boil down to misinformation. Somebody puts out some sort of information out of self-interest, that could be commercial interest, or out of quasi-religious belief that this or that treatment is wonderful, and puts out some truly harmful misinformation, and then the scientist steps in. The thing is that in alternative medicine there are not many scientists, and it had dawned on me only recently that if you look at any other field in medicine, let's say pharmacology, you have people who research that field, they're called pharmacologists, and you have people who criticize that field, and these may be all sorts of people, But there's a huge overlap. In fact, I don't know a single pharmacologist who is not also a critic of some of the things that are happening in pharmacology. In alternative medicine, these two groups are totally separate. There are those who criticize, some of them around the table here, and those who research. And there's not no overlap. And I feel that perhaps I'm the only one in the world who has actually done a lot of research into the field and who also speaks out against the field. If an acupuncturist looks at homeopathy, he or she may agree that this is idiotically implausible, but they will never ever say this cannot work, it doesn't work, the data doesn't show it works, etc., etc. So there's no internal criticism. And how do we make progress in healthcare? By having internal criticism, because the external criticism, for instance, in homeopathy has existed since 200 years, yet it has developed into a dogma, and the field hasn't moved on at all. So I think we have to ask ourselves, why do these two groups, the critics and the researchers, not overlap much, much more than they do?
Well, Bob, maybe you have something to say on that, because I know your weekly newsletter ends with the statement that these news may not be shared by the University of Maryland, but they should be. maybe you can comment on the scientific community and whether or not your views are, to what extent they're supported or opposed, because, I mean, you certainly promote evidence-based science.
I do, and I get very little criticism from the scientific community. Most of the comments I get are very positive. But it seems to me part of the problem here is that the language of science is mathematics. And a lot of people simply don't speak that language. They don't speak it at all. And I don't know what to do about that. I don't know how you convince people that they ought to do that when there are very rich people around who don't know any math at all. But it's those two languages that are bothering me in all this. It's not difficult math. Most of the math that silly things I debunk, like homeopathy, it's not difficult math. It's below calculus.
But you know, can I comment? Can we?
Sure, sure.
See, I think you do a great job of that, though. I mean, in both of your books, in Buddhist Science and in Superstition and the Age of Reason, although I would argue we may not be in the Age of Reason, but I think you know, what you do is you tell a story. I think we're human, we're compelled by story, and so you're right that it is the language of math, and so it ultimately comes down to a statistical argument. But I think you frame that statistical argument in an emotional, compelling, human way. It's what makes your book so compelling. So I think you do that.
Yes, but it's actually interesting. For a project I've been working on, I've been talking to geneticists and genetic counselors and asking them, talking about risks related to carrying certain genes. And I say, well, how do you talk to people? Because if you say there's a 12% chance of something, what does that mean? Because, in fact, it would be my observation that nobody in their life actually goes around with an equation that they are calculating the risks and benefits of stuff happening to them. They sort of say, well, that looks kind of risky, or that doesn't look very much, or whatever. But that it actually doesn't work. And so I say to them, like, how do you talk? And actually, the answer I keep getting back is, well, we don't have a way of quantifying this well, or describing it. We just continue to talk to them. And eventually, I think they come around to the decision that the council would like them to make, as opposed to, I think, really understanding the risks of Stockport.
I have to come back on that because, you know, traditionally, the traditional geneticist, and particularly statistical geneticists, will always say you have to calculate the exact risk. Otherwise, you may end up with exactly the wrong information. But in practice, you know, the weather forecast is there's going to be 20% chance of rain tomorrow. You take your umbrella. And the public doesn't really respond to it. You can hear three weather forecasters give the weather forecast and say it's not going to rain tomorrow, it's only 20% risk. But for an autosomal recessive disease, if you've got a 25% risk, you consider that a very high risk. And then within families, it's not so much a matter of risk, it's a matter of burden. What have they seen? What has that disease meant to them in the family? So the number, in fact, is very important. In fact, the impact on the person is more experiential than what they know about that disease, what that disease means to them. So, yes, the math is there, but you can't determine in advance how a particular person is going to react to the information you get. So, in fact, you do have to keep talking to see what the patient wants, what the person wants out of the exposure, because remember, geneticists are not eugenicists. The geneticists are people telling people what the most likely scenario is so they can take that into their value system and use the information the way it's useful to them. We're not looking for any particular outcome.
Actually, in sort of following up, I don't want to monopolize this, but I actually wrote about the autism thing, and one of the things I did is actually look at people not part of the debate, but people who had children with autism, and read their views of what was going on, and read their passion about wanting to believe, for example, that it was vaccination. And if you read, I think not very deeply through it, the reason why they wanted to believe it is because evidence-based medicine was telling them, we don't know. Why is it that your kid has, why did my child have autism and someone else? Well, there's some genetic components and maybe, but we don't know. And to tell people that we're, you know, you have this condition of which we have no explanation, and that's what we get when we, or no good explanation. No explanation that can tell you, look, if you'd have done this and this and this, you could have, you know, saved your child from having this. It was completely unsatisfying.
Yeah, I agree with you, but what I would say is that this gets something Mr. Brownstein said earlier. I think the vaccine autism controversy will never fully die until one can say this is what causes it, or these are the things that cause it, and this is what cures it, if we ever get to that point. But I think that there are a lot of very good studies pointing to what really are the cause or causes of autism. They obviously have nothing to do with vaccines. We haven't been very good at getting those stories out there, primarily because I think the anti-vaccine people have taken the story hostage. Secondly, when I wrote the book Autism of All Problems, I expected a wave of sort of negative emails and mail about that book, but got the opposite. I got hundreds of letters from parents who said, thank you, I never thought vaccines were it. This frankly makes me feel better because I thought I had done this to my child, and now I realize I hadn't. So I think they're the silent majority. You don't hear, as Richard Nixon used to reassure himself, that there were people out there supporting him. I think that's true here, too. I think there are a lot of people out there who never thought this was it, but they're not the squeakiest wheel, so you don't hear from them as much. So certainly the media doesn't attend to them as much, but you don't hear their stories.
The point is very, very interesting and very good, because it's a bigger point which I see throughout alternative medicine. Patients are often dissatisfied with what conventional medicine has to offer. They go from one doctor to the other, unexplained symptoms. Finally, somebody suggests it's all in their head anyway, and they're just pretending to be ill. Eventually, this person comes to, say, an acupuncturist. And for the first time in this long history, there's a eureka moment in the patient, because the acupuncturist says, I know exactly what is wrong with you. Your yin and yang are out of balance. It's total bullshit, of course, but the patient feels understood, and that is the important thing.
I would like to suggest, though, it may be bullshit in one perspective, but the acupuncturist won't be effective unless he or she believes, and let's give some credit, sincerely, that the therapy can help the patient, or the patient forms a connection with the acupuncturist, and completely right, a sense, oh, maybe there's some meaning, maybe there's something that can be done, maybe things will be okay. The explanation, I think many patients, maybe it's just mine, are a little smarter than we sometimes give them credit for. They know some things. But this particular case, I agree, you've got a mysterious case, you've got a troubled patient that goes to the acupuncturist. I'm highly skeptical of acupuncture. Homeopathy is even a better example. It's almost like a made-to-order example of a treatment that is totally impossible to be effective. So that even makes it a beautiful example to suggest that there's something else happening. It's not the acupuncture or this treatment or that treatment. There's another process happening that we don't understand it very well. We can talk about placebo effect, but that's just a label for a phenomenon that's profoundly mysterious and important and acts. And it is possible that there is something to be learned. But if we just concentrate on the particular medium that and some people, you know, and I don't think that all alternative therapists will have this, but some have a certain manner, and I think some of my physician colleagues have that too. There's a certain kind of way that one can establish a relationship with a patient. There's a feeling of trust, of confidence, of listening, of being heard by the therapist, and medicine falls down greatly. Dr. Hall, I agree with what you said. A lot of integrative practice has developed and grown because as medicine became more and more mechanical, there was a certain withdrawal, withdrawal of a certain kind of connection that's very, very important to patients who have other than minor transient illnesses, patients who have chronic disease, mysterious or not. But something may happen. And there's something that isn't well understood, and I feel humble enough when I've got a patient who is doing badly, for conventional medicine's not doing the job adequately, and God knows in integrative medicine that's a large proportion of the patients. I'm open-minded. If a patient comes to me and says, I went to see a homeopath and my symptoms got markedly better. I felt better. I felt a sense of maybe in my life I could take control, a certain sense of anxiety being relieved. Should I go back to the homeopathic therapist for another treatment? What am I going to tell that patient? Oh, no, it's unscientific. It can't possibly work. Don't do it. That might be intellectually rigorous, but it would be absolutely the wrong medical advice.
I'd like to mention the research that Fabrizio Benedetti has been doing. He's written a couple of books and written many papers. He's doing research on the neurophysiology of the placebo effect. He does brain scans. He finds what is actually happening to the patient's brain and nervous system when they're responding to a placebo. And the hope is that if we can learn enough about that, we can use that along with effective conventional medicines.
I think that's a very important point.
I look forward to that day.
We used to call it the art of medicine as opposed to the science of medicine. And this dichotomy is haunting us a little bit. Those who are very good at science in medicine are very poor at the art of medicine and vice versa. But it should be either or. Good medicine is both of it. And we absolutely mustn't let the art, wanting a better word for this side of medicine, be hijacked by quacks.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're letting it happen, aren't we?
So I want to go back maybe to Bill. My view, if I look at movies. I have an image of the man comes back from the Vietnam War and he goes to his chiropractor. The chiropractor is there as the god. In what I see in movies and I see in books, the alternate people end up as the more colorful characters who are the healers. And how do we educate our artistic community, our non-scientific community, that you can't tell them you're doing harm by depicting people?
No, it's the Maverick syndrome, you know, the romantic hero. But that being said, Joe told me something very interesting. I was telling him, but I had sciatica. A lot of people, actually, I know, same thing. And I went to an osteopath, I went to a physio, I went to all sorts of people. And the doctor, conventional doctor, told me try acupuncture. Because, and as Joe pointed out, I'll tell you afterward, it worked. And other people I know, it worked. But we talked about that. He says, yes, but it doesn't cure cancer. And I agree, but he wasn't talking about the yin and yang or anything being out of proportion. But for whatever reason, the guy said, I don't want you to have some sort of spinal fusion. I don't want you to have an operation. Try this. And the same thing happened with six other people I know, and it all worked. I mean, he never gave us any lectures about ancient Chinese herbal remedies or anything like that. But it worked.
And we give amoxicillin for otitis media caused by viruses, and the patients get better.
I think they wouldn't get back in India.
And they'd get better if we didn't get it either,
but
you know,
nonetheless,
I'm just saying.
But it was a conventional doctor.
But it's not outside the realm of science. I mean, so there are, if you feel better, I mean, if you have less pain, it's either because you have the same pain but you're more tolerant, or you truly have less pain, which may be based on endorphin release or whatever, but it's all within the realm of science. One doesn't have to appeal to mystics or magic or the gods to try and explain it.
But it was a doctor who actually told me to try, because he said, as opposed to having a disc operation or something, try this.
And when it works for a reason.
Right.
You know, so
the danger there, and I think that the one thing we haven't touched upon that much, is what does it cost us? What does it cost society when we not only not, you know, when groups like this sit around and talk about how, you know, alternative medicine is potentially a danger to our patients and we've got to educate them, but what about the social cost, the financial cost? Because there are public health systems in the world in very civilized countries where alternative medicine is actually covered by the state. There's actually serious dollars being spent on things like homeopathy and other alternative care, dollars that are not being spent on the conventional side. And I think the more that happens overseas, the more there's a pressure for that to happen here. Opinion leaders are already talking about that, but including certain aspects of alternative medicine in our public health care programs. And that's a danger in a political and financial period where dollars are very tight and we have barely enough dollars to spend on conventional medicine. Now we're talking about diverting some of those same dollars into techniques that are unproven at best and dangerous at worst. And to me, that's the problem. A lot of this anecdotal evidence now becomes almost a public push towards something that will have a long-term consequence, and that is the diversion of money towards these.
I think the current statistic, I think it was in the paper yesterday, in Canada, is $5.6 billion a year that are spent on alternative regimens.
Well, in the last 10 years, the National Council for Complementary and Alternative Medicine spent $2.5 billion on studies, not a single one of which has shown any positive outcome to any of these techniques. So that's $2.5 billion that one could argue could have been spent on much more useful programs.
Right.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Two quick points, and then maybe a bigger subject. First of all, in the institution I work in, one of my clinics at the old Queen Elizabeth Hospital, it's written in stone, the Royal Homeopathic Hospital. The second quick point is 30% of Montrealers do not have access to a family doctor. Through our Medicare system, because of the importance of family doctors, they were nationalized. And because they were nationalized, they were then reduced by the government to control costs. So the ironic thing is we're so important that our numbers have been cut severely. That's one of the other reasons why alternative medicine is very popular in Montreal, because they can't even get to see a regular doctor. 30% of the population can't even see a regular doctor. But one of the interesting points that I'm very optimistic about is where science is compared to what it was, you know, 30 years ago.
science is advancing. What we considered evidence for science when I was in medical school would be considered third-level evidence right now. Listening to our professor talk about what he was doing just doesn't make it anymore. To say your article was published in the front page of Journal of Medicine just is a lower level of evidence. And now we have this fantastic revolution in medicine that has sometimes countered our interests. You know, the annual checkup for a 40-year-old, there's no evidence to support it anymore. Very bad for my income. Well, if I had the competition for patients, but for a competitive position, it would be orthopedic operations to clean up your knee, no longer supported. Physiotherapy, going back to work early is the best therapy for low back pain. I mean, I tell, if you want to get your patient out of your office complaining about his back pain, you tell them to go to work. You can tell them to do acupuncture, anything that kills a couple of weeks. And they will get better 95% of the time. There was a saying in medicine that our medication was useless but safe. Now our medication is effective but dangerous, an overdose. So I'm very optimistic that the revolution in medicine that's hit us over the last 20 years is now seeping out into the general public, into other science fields. It's easier in physics because we're dealing with a rather multifactorial complex organism here. In physics, you can isolate your house, but in medicine, we are improving our science, and we are going to, I think, get that out to the general public. And that's why I get back to a highly educated group who are able to communicate that to the public, like Joe Schwartz on his show in the media, and other journalists do a fantastic job. I'm very optimistic that gradually, and eventually I would say, I would like to see evidence-based political decisions.
I do ask the two journalists something here, because I mean, you guys are opinion swayers, you know, and in journalism school, generally you're taught to present both sides, right? I mean, now, I've had enough experience with this from journalists coming to interview me. They get my opinion, then they will go somewhere to get the opposite opinion. And then they write up the piece, and it looks as if those two are equal, because they have to present both sides. And we see this in the climate change arguments all the time. You see articles in the lay press, go to one expert, go to the other expert, the story comes out as if this is a legitimate argument, whereas in that case there is no legitimate argument, because what doesn't come across is that on one side, whoever's making the statement may have the whole scientific community behind them, the other side has a few very clever and vocal outliers, but they make a case very well.
Fortunately, I'm a columnist, so I'm allowed to say my opinion and put it forward, and I mean, you examine, and as long as people don't come down and try to stone you or something and say, you know, or there's this huge hue and cry about what you said, you can get away with it. But the point is that, like, I wrote a column on this conference, and I didn't get anybody, you know, it was clear, like, how I felt, that there was a lot of nonsense medicine going around, a lot of quackery and all the rest, and I'd, except for one email, I got no negative reaction whatsoever, but more of it, people saying, yes, we have to have truth come out because people are being taken advantage of. But your point is well taken. If I were just to write, like, a straight reportage of this, then I would speak to the person who's very still believes that vaccination causes autism, and then you would be presenting two sides, you'd be having both sides of the equation there, and in a sense, you're right. So someone would read this and say, well, you know, they both have their theories, but fortunately, I'm able to, you know, go with what I believe.
But do you present it as a cultural controversy or a scientific controversy?
Scientific. I mean, you know,
even if it's not a scientific controversy.
No, but I'm saying in the case of the autism, I mean, because of the outbreak of the epidemics and measles and so on and so forth, I mean, there is science, and the fact is that the guy who first proposed that theory in the Lancet way back when, was debunked and was fraudulent and all the rest. But Joe is right, to the extent that you, if a reporter were just to write that story, he would probably get someone from that other side to make a passionate argument about why they still believe that to be the truth. And that is, and you know, you talk about climate change, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing for everything. You can write about why, you know, like there is global warming, there's not global warming, and I mean, there's so many sides, and there's so many people who are so vocal that if you don't give one side their, like, their platform, then the other side, I mean, you know, and then it becomes, like you say, it just becomes very, very confusing.
But I actually think that the difference is, and global warming is actually an interesting example, but it actually applies again to alternative medicines. What you're dealing with when you're presenting the story is not people who are intellectually interested in something and what the scientists have to say. You're actually dealing with people's experience. So if you're looking at global warming, for example, what happens is, geez, it turns out to be a really cold summer and it rains all the time. And what the hell, you guys said that it was going to be global warming, and look, there it is, and my vacation has been ruined, etc. That is to say, everyone has experience, if not with climate, they have experience with weather. And what they see in their experience with weather is that it's contradictory. What they don't see is a line like this. They see the ups and downs. That is, in fact, what happens. But in fact, it becomes, it, in their personal experience, it contradicts the science. The same way, I guess I would argue, when you look at what happens with medicine, coming back to my initial remark, if in fact you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you're perfectly fine, there's nothing wrong with you, and you say, gee, I'm still feeling really, really bad, and the doctor says, well, you know, based on the evidence of the examinations that we've done, there's nothing, you know, I can see nothing wrong with you. Well, actually, there is your evidence, that is the evidence of how you feel, how you responded to treatment, tells you that it's not effective, it's not right. And with that as your, as the basis, you go off to other places, because in fact, it's not the science of, in an abstract sense, it's your experience that moves you. And that actually, in part, informs what journalism is about. It, you know, becomes this, the stories of, here's what I know, not based on science, but on, you know, my life.
Brian?
Well, I think we've all heard stories about the juries, where the CSI effect, where the jury is sitting there and, you know, they hear what the prosecutor has to say, and they think, you know, where's the DNA evidence? You know, where's the cloned and expressed protein, damn it? You know, you guys aren't doing your job. And I think to some extent we are suffering the same effect, in that everyone with a chronic disease expects House to come in and make the diagnosis and save the day. And I think that because of the mainstream media's focus, I mean, every newspaper, every day in the television, there are cures for this or that that are valued, or that they may be cures for this or that from traditional medicine. So I think a lot of people go to alternative medicine when a House doesn't appear and where there isn't a diagnosis. And they're actually quite willing to accept a partial cure or a little bit of an advance from an alternate healthcare professional, because that's better than nothing. So that they actually give the alternate healthcare people a buy on efficacy, while they expect us to cure it. And I think that's partly our fault, that we've oversold ourselves. We've oversold traditional medicine, and so
because we're ruled by industry.
Because
I mean, traditional medicine is ruled by industry.
The perfect example of that is the whole controversy with the Zamboni treatment for multiple sclerosis.
Yes.
And you know, here's a treatment proposed by a conventional doctor who decided through his own research that you know, this may be the cause and the cure of MS, which is a horrible disease, and unfortunately affects Canadians per capita almost more than any other country. And before there's any hard science behind it, before the studies are done, you've got all of these people rushing to Romania and other countries where the treatment is being offered at their own expense. And this is exactly what it comes back to what I said before, because of this popular movement, basically desperate people looking for any sort of answer to their incurable problem, smart people, people who are well-read and know a lot about their own disease but are just looking for something. And this mass movement, without any real science behind it, has caused the Canadian government to actually sponsor studies retroactively on this treatment. And it's really probably the epitome of what I was talking about before, where it's now the masses leading the science and the dollars that go with it. And I think we're going to see more and more of this, where we're going to get a lot of public pressure to put money towards the treatment.
Very interesting to bring that up, because I had a conversation just on that with a Canadian member of parliament about all the testing for the Sandponi procedure, and he said, we live in a democracy, and our role as a government is to do the people's will, or to follow the people's will. And the public is right even when they're wrong. So I think that virtually every member of that committee that decided on doing the clinical trials on the Zamboni procedure agreed that it was likely a futile effort. But the decision was a political one, because the MS community, of course, understandably is clamoring.
But Joe, virtually every medical this decision is a political one. Newborn screening for inherited disorders in Ontario, they had this go from worst to first, because one parent of a child contacted the ombudsman, made a huge political stir in Ontario, and got it in. It was never based on basic, rational, scientific advice. Almost never leads to public policy. It's always politics that leads to public policy. That's why I disagree a little bit with what you're saying. I don't think there's any evidence that good science makes for good government.
I'm not saying that the government follows good science. I'm saying that
even the other way around. I'm not even sure that good science leads to good government, because unfortunately, people are complex, and the way they act is complex. Some of the most science-friendly countries have been very, very devastated.
I'm not against what Canada is doing with the MS situation. You've taken a preliminary study, which is the lowest level of evidence, and what Canada is doing is trying to take it up to the higher level of evidence. I'm not against that. I don't think anyone at this table would be against that. But we have to realize there are weaknesses in our present scientific method. To do a double-blind prospective study that meets the rigor of the best level of evidence takes a lot of money. A lot of that money is available, say, in industry, but there are other areas that have not reached that level of evidence that we need to look at. And one of the flaws in our system, and more so in the States, is that the research money is controlled by industry and they have a self-interest. And there's a far greater role for disinterested parties. I don't know if you can call governments disinterested parties. There needs to be a mass of research money available for those studies to take place. Whether it be, I consider a popular treatment in Shanghai, an interesting preliminary study. It's a little flag that something may be going on, and it warrants another study to bring up a higher level of evidence. To get that money around is rather complex to do. You're going to a drug company who maybe has a conflict of interest.
Got just one thing. I'd like to take the unpopular point of view, since no one has expressed this. And I think certainly there are many lures to alternative medicine, but one is, I think, that it is seen as being apart from conventional medicine, that it isn't ruled by the pharmaceutical industry, as four people have said at this table so far. Just a word on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry. When we had our strains in the late 1980s, the bovine human reassorted strains ultimately became Rotatec, the vaccine Rotatec, Only a pharmaceutical company has the resources and expertise to develop that product. I mean, only they were going to spend roughly $1.2 billion it took to do all the studies that got that ultimately in the children's mouths. Only they have it. And they are held to a very high standard of safety and efficacy by the FDA. What's ironic to me is that if you go into a human nutrition center and you look at what's on that shelf, there is no guarantee that what it says is in there is in there. At any, you know, whether it's actually in there, whether it's in there higher level, or whether there's other things that are in there, because it is an unregulated, unsupervised industry that is somehow looked at as safer, and because it's not ruled by the pharmaceutical industry. NCAM, to me, is the ultimate eye, this National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, because what they are is like a post-licensure FDA. I mean, after something is on the shelf claiming that it, you know, it's an immune support formula or, you know, or arthritis formula or whatever, then it's tested. I mean, after it's already out there, or not. I mean,
that's the chemical manifestation of the buy that I was talking about that alternative medicine gets. We're held to this standard. And if we can't get something to work, then they'll accept the general public will accept a much lower standard because it's better than nothing.
Sure. Now we've been talking about evidence-based science for so long, but one of the biggest problems is that unfortunately the majority of the public is not able to understand what that means, what evidence-based science is. I'll give you a little anecdote. And I have many others like this, but I was once taking aim at a product called aerobic oxygen, which comes in a bottle, it's a total quack product, but, you know, claims that it cures every disease known to mankind. And I went on the radio about 5 minutes talking about this, explaining the science behind it. It has a touch of potassium chlorate in it. I even calculated how much oxygen, you know, that could possibly release, told them that, in fact, we tend to breathe through our nose, not through our gut, and that, you know, the amount of oxygen there was totally inconsequential. There was absolutely no rationale for this. Okay. 5 minute harangue. We go to the phone lines. What is the first question? Where can I get it? This is literally.
But there's no limit to what you can advertise on the radio station.
Sure.
As Mark said, there's no limit on what you can say in public. But at least when I was going through medical school, pharmaceutical companies were not allowed to say, go ask your doctor to give you Viagra or Cialis. I mean, it was against professional conduct. We've lost any concept of professional conduct or standards.
You cannot actually refuse an ad on the radio. I mean, I've had huge, huge arguments over this because they snuck in onto my show a detox ad for some idiotic product. And so,
you know, how did you feel?
Well,
you went straight to that.
I totally, you know, blew it away. I mean, like, I wasn't shy about saying that this should not be advertised. And so went all the way up to the general manager, who I had a long talk with, about the legalistics of all of this. Mm. And the fact is that unless they are saying something that is wrong, you know, totally, and they're very careful because they use the qualifiers, made and all of this, you cannot refuse an ad because the airwaves are public. And you cannot refuse someone wanting to put their message on the public airways unless it's somehow defamatory or there's something scientifically incorrect about it.
And because they don't, so your point is very well taken. You listen to pharmaceutical ads, American television, the side effects are more frightening than the disease, but they have to come clean and all of that. I've written a story, I mean, very humorous, but like you're listening to, you know, all the zillion side effects that you could take for, you know, something for your prostate, as opposed to the station that Joe was talking about that comes on talking about some nonsense like medicine. They have a half an hour in the morning on TJG of all these, like, from skin care to prostate care to all these things. No side effects. There's no accountability
there's
whatsoever.
No spackle? You mean there's no spackle?
There's no spackle.
Like all of these things, but they have no accountability. But the public listens to that. No one's disputing this. This is great. And there are no side effects. I mean, something for your... I mean, you listen to these ads so far. I mean, it's frightening. You'd rather have the disease.
They're harmless, but in a second. I mean, they're used like homeopathy. It's an extremely harmless
treatment because it's so ineffective. I mean, it's like
unless you avoid going to the
unless you avoid the other treatment. I would tell you, I mean, I got a call from a mother who believed in homeopathy, and she called me and said, I was told to call you. I wanted your advice. I don't go to doctors usually, but my 14-year-old son is having difficulty with his lymphoma that he was diagnosed with 5 years ago. And as well, she received treatment. No, but he's doing well in homeopathy. The lymph nodes are getting bigger. And as a matter of fact, he has to extend his neck to breathe. So I'm on the phone, and I felt like saying, what are you? You're the mother, you're a murderer. And I said, if I do that, she's going to hang up. I've got her. Well, I've got to get that hook in her mouth and get her into the emergency. So I said, you know, there's a special treatment for that, especially for homeopathic treatment. So I lied, I must admit. And I said, go to the emerge at the Montreal Children's.
This is being recorded.
Immediately. and then I called the emerge and said, this kid's coming in, get the papers, take steps to get this kid in proper care. And that's what they did. As soon as the patient was taken in their room, got the IVs going, and this kid needed to be intubated, and got the lymphoma therapy, which of course was effective, and the mother had some things to say. I mean, it is heartbreaking. I mean, we talked about waste of money, we said, but a case like that,
it's amazing how parents' rights trump the rights of the child. I mean, who looks out for the health and well-being of that child? And the parents making a terrible decision that could kill her child, and that's okay, right?
No, it wasn't okay. We just knew about it. The moment we knew about it, we had to take.
No, but I'm saying it's criminal.
Really, we just saw two young women, McGill students, who were heading off. This was in the travel clinic, and they were heading off for a 3-month stage in Uganda, and their parents were anti-vaccinationists. And so these two sisters had never received any vaccines, and now we're going off to rural Uganda for 3.5 months. That's an extremely... then basically, the young women came in and said, we, you know, protect us. And
but they came.
But they came.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to start wrapping up because I'm sure the hunger pangs are setting in and dinner is waiting. You know, someone who is thankful for the benefits of homeopathy, the daughter of Billy Joel, and who's his wife, Billy Joel?
Christy Grace.
Yeah. The daughter tried to commit suicide by taking an overdose of homeopathy. So homeopathy does have some benefits.
No, I've been intrigued since we're, Ms. Ariel and I are not in the medical community. I've been intrigued by the fact that the ethical placebo is making its way or making its rounds. And this reminded me that if you go back to William Osler, who founded McGill's medical program and Johns Hopkins medical program, basically said, listen to the patient because the patient will tell you what's wrong with them. And this almost seems like that's a third of what's happening these days, whether we like it or not, or if we believe it or not.
The problem is, I think, in medicine in particular, but in society in general, that authority figures have lost their authority.
Exactly.
And, you know, the internet has become the authority for many people, and you know, the usual neighbor, mother, daughter, relatives know better. And so we're challenged a lot more. And because of the internet, we're challenged now with not just anecdote, but, you know, pseudo studies. You know, I read that so-and-so said this, and so it's a little more difficult, or, you know, it's a little more difficult now to convince patients that you do know a little bit more than they do about their particular problem. But there's also that feeling in society that doctors are in collusion with the pharmaceutical industry, and much of what we say is, you know, we're really the mouthpieces for the big pharma companies, and that's unfortunate, but partly our fault because there have been unfortunate situations where that has come out, like the Wakefield case, etc. So. It's going to be a long road before we can reverse that trend.
Okay, let's wrap up. We will give one or two last sentences to each of our panelists here. Only ask a good question.
Let's start on the other side.
Start on the other side. We'll start with Bob Fire. Suppose there was a baby and you could implant an idea right from the beginning that would stay with them for the rest of their life. What would it be?
Causality. Absolutely. And it will stay with them the rest of their life. I mean, that's the big problem. If we what we learn in that period of life when we're learning our first language is almost impossible to expunge after that. And if we could get the idea of cause and effect across, that completely wipes out superstition. Think of all the problems that would solve.
I like causality. Mine is very similar. I would say, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that relates to causality.
I'd like to elaborate a little on causality. I think one of our biggest problems in critical thinking is the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. I like to think of it as the rooster fallacy. The rooster crowed and the sun came up, therefore the rooster made the sun come up. And we fall into that error all the time in medicine. I had a treatment, I got better, therefore the treatment made me better. But it may not have. And I have a little anecdote that I thought would play a good counterpoint to what Mr. Brownstein said. A man I know had back pain that just wouldn't go away. And he never thought much of chiropractors, but his pain was really annoying and so broke down. On Friday, he called a chiropractor's office and made an appointment to see the chiropractor on Monday. On Saturday, his back pain vanished, and it never came back. And he said, I was so lucky, because if I'd seen that chiropractor on Friday, I would have thought he'd cured my back pain, and I would have been going in for maintenance chiropractic treatments the rest of my life.
Yeah, I guess this gets to something that was stressed earlier, just in terms of our ability to understand where the real risks lie, I mean, which is in part understanding the statistics of it. The New York State Lottery gets people to buy a lot of tickets to play a 35 million to one shot by simply saying it can happen to you. That's a very effective ad campaign. And so we're scared of dioxin and radon and bisphenol A and then organophosphates and flame retardants, but we're not scared of French fries and the things that really are much more likely to do us harm. I guess I would, if we could just find a way to very early on get people to understand where the real risks lie. I mean, the biggest risk of getting a vaccine is driving to the office to get it.
Well, no French fries for supper. We have seen the menu. So thanks everyone for that very interesting and fruitful discussion. I'm sure it will continue over dinner. So we'll adjourn from here and go upstairs and enjoy the food and the lively conversation.